Curse to you.
Okay. That'll be hard.
This interview with Dr. Charles Berry, Director of Medical Operations, is that the
medical
right way?
Research and Operations.
Director of Medical Research and Operations, the Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston, Texas. That's slug information. In other words, he's a head doctor.
The head shrinker.
That'll go on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, I figure it would.
Doctor, huh?
You could say he's the head nigger.
Oh, God, wait a minute.
I gotta cut that out.
Okay.
You know, this is terrible. We got to get some time where we can get you down to the house again. This is something awful. I haven't even seen our house, I tell you.
Not for 2 weeks.
I haven't.
3 weeks, huh?
That's right.
Since the measles broke out. What are you going to do about the epidemic all around here?
Well, we've got an epidemic around here.
I think you do.
We really do. Chris's daughter has it now. You haven't had the mumps?
Should I get immunized?
I would if I were you.
I wasn't aware there was a mumps vaccine.
Yeah, there is now. Yeah. There is now. It's just new. That's the thing.
The one I'd be afraid
You're
of.
You're dang right. It's an adult, a male adult. It's a bad disease. Mm. It really is.
Okay. We'll back off and come in fresh for All India Radio.
All right.
Dr. Berry, Apollo 13 has been a great challenge to you in the medical profession, because you've had to get three men back safely under great stress, also under less than ideal conditions. And I'm sure that you would agree this would more or less climax an era of aerospace medicine. I don't know what we look for beyond this other than living through a fatality if it ever occurs in spaceflight. But how do you feel now that Apollo 13 is over? Do you think that the astronauts are in good shape?
Yes, Red, I think that we have three astronauts who have come back in amazingly good shape from the stresses to which they were exposed during the latter part of this flight. They were extremely cold. The temperature in the command module was down to 38 degrees Fahrenheit. 38 degrees Fahrenheit, and this cold was being finally, the cold soak was so deep that they began to get cold even down into the lunar module during the latter day of the flight, the last day.
The lifeboat.
The old lifeboat. And, of course, this interfered with their capability to sleep and the fact that they couldn't sleep in the command module at all, and so they began to try and all stay in the limb and in the tunnel. And this made it very difficult for them to get any adequate rest. So fatigue was a very marked factor here. Now, the only individual that's had any post-flight difficulty of note, of course, was astronaut Fred Hayes, who did have a urinary tract infection, which developed due to some of the decrease in the water intake and the fact that they had less than adequate hygiene due to some of the situations during that sort of survival situation they were in at the end of the mission. And as a result of this, an organism which was normally present did infect and involve the urinary tract, and of course he has been treated, as you know, and done well since then.
Hold it. Dr. Berry, this was then the only illness which developed during the flight, during the emergency?
Yes, there was a lot of discomfort due to this cold and the fatigue, but it's the only true illness that we've had in conjunction with the mission.
Well, sir, we'd like to discuss with you overall aerospace medicine, but to give our listeners a little perspective of how you operate the medical operations here, I think we must discuss just a bit more Apollo 13. There were so many challenges and so many things happened in it that I think that your decision-making processes would be quite revealing. Let's go back to the few days before launch, when you discovered that you may have had a case of rubella on your hands among the flight crews. What happened originally?
Well, we were faced with a very unusual situation in that we have a preventive medicine program which tries to limit the contacts of the crew during the 21 days before a launch.
Now, this is a normal procedure with all astronauts in spaceflight.
That's correct. Prior to any launch, there is a possibility that an individual could be exposed to some organism. And the common things that give us difficulty, of course, are the viral diseases, viral upper respiratory diseases, influenza-like syndromes involving either the respiratory system or the gastrointestinal system. And in all of these instances, there is a possibility that you could be exposed and still not develop the disease until maybe just before flight, which would be sort of a disaster, or you could develop it in flight, which could limit your capability to actually accomplish the mission.
Now, that's something I'd like for us to go into a little later, is the questions about what could happen in the space environment. But continue with what happened on this mission.
Well, now, this particular instance occurred just, as a matter of fact, a week prior to launch, when on the... It was actually on April the 5th, Sunday, April the 5th, we had one of the backup crewmen,
Charlie Duke,
who had not been feeling well since Friday, but he couldn't put his finger on exactly what it was that was bothering him. He just had some general aching and didn't feel well.
Mm-hmm.
And on Sunday, this progressed to the point where he had fever, generalized aching, and he broke out in a rash, which was diagnosed on Sunday evening as being rubella or the German measles. Now, this particular episode, you'd say, well, how important is that? It was extremely important to us because all of the crew had been together, the prime and the backup crews.
This is six astronauts
working very closely together, and they had been particularly close together on the 2nd of April in the evening when they had a long meeting that lasted for several hours, and they were together in a small room working over some plans for the mission.
So they would have been leaning over a table over charts and graphs and flight plans,
yes,
and things together.
And it was a beautiful exposure if you were trying to do one, and at a time when certainly the virus could have been transmitted by astronaut Duke. As a result of this, it became extremely important for us to have some idea of the immune status of all of the prime crewmen. Now, a few years ago, this wouldn't have been possible because the tests weren't available to us, but we do draw blood from all of our crewmen at a time of each examination, starting 30 days before the flight, then 15 days before the flight, and 5 days before. And we take blood at each one of these, and we store some of that blood as a serum sample. We also store it from every exam that we do on our crew, even the annual exams. So we have that available to go back and check certain things. One of the things we certainly could check here was the immunity level to the rubella virus in this case. So we...
the key point the revelation to you then came 7 days before the flight was to leave the Earth.
That's correct. It was 7 days prior to launch that we were faced with this particular problem. Now, we had some additional concern in the first 24 hours because astronaut Jim Lovell's young son, Jeffrey, had also developed the real measles, Rubiola.
All right, we're talking about two strains, rubella, sometimes called German measles, and rubiola, or common old red measles.
That's right. And he was very ill with this for about almost a week prior to the time that Charlie Duke developed the rubella. Now, he was in the Cape. He had also been in the Cape area for 4 days prior to the time that Charlie Duke developed his illness, and so we had to take this into consideration too. And we wanted to be very sure, number one, exactly which disease young Mr. Lovell had, as well as exactly which disease Charlie Duke had. Now, clinically, we felt that he had rubella. We needed to have some laboratory confirmation, and it takes a while to develop an immune titer that you can measure by laboratory methods.
A titer, a titration of blood components.
Yes, it's chemically. The amount of the level of antibody that you have developed toward this particular virus as an antigen, in other words. So the ability to make these tests was very key to our being able to come up with evidence to help us make a decision in this particular instance, and also the capability to not only make a specific diagnosis in each of these instances, but then to be able to follow an individual who had the disease and find out what his immune response to that particular illness was. Mm-hmm. So and we had two things and we had to follow carefully. One of them was to make sure that we did get a positive diagnosis on Charlie Duke. And over a period of about 5 days, we were able to do that. It certainly, from the time of the rash, that's about the earliest you could expect to see any change. And we did see this, and we finally got a positive diagnosis. We got that finally on late Thursday.
Now we're 2 days before lunch.
2 days before lunch. Now, we also, in the meantime, had been working very hard to check the immunity level of the other prime crewmen.
The other five astronauts.
And as a result, we found that four of the others were immune. They had immunity levels which would protect them from rubella. There was one of the crewmen, astronaut Mattingly, Kenneth Mattingly, who had no evidence of immunity at all to this virus. As a result, we checked this in several laboratories as well as our own, and this was confirmed that he had no immunity. So here we were faced with a situation wherein looking at the incubation period of the disease, which is 14 to 21 days, we were having to decide whether we were willing then to launch an individual who had very definitely been exposed to rubella,
to which he was definitely immune.
To which he had no immunity. To which he had absolutely no immunity. And therefore, the odds we felt of him developing this disease, from everything that that we could glean from any expert available to us, we looked at a lot of literature from European countries and countries in even in South America. The world literature was reviewed in a great hurry, as well as talking to a number of experts, and it became increasingly obvious to us that the possibility of him developing this disease with this exposure and this level of immunity was at least 75%. And this made it almost imperative that we make a very difficult decision, and I had to recommend medically to Dr. Payne, the administrator of NASA, that from a medical viewpoint, I felt that this was a great risk as far as the mission was concerned, and that I certainly felt that he had a high chance of coming down with this disease, and that in an adult, the possibilities of having complications of this disease are very high. And therefore, we stood a risk of compromising the mission if we did launch him. And then it got down to a choice of whether you were then going to have to delay the mission for a month because it would be necessary because of the launch capabilities, or whether you would try and substitute one of the backup crewmen who happened to be immune to the disease.
Well, now you have revealed, I think, two or three interesting points of policy on how you handle astronauts in this situation. Number one, obviously you don't want to put them in test tubes and a completely sanitary situation for the last month before launch. I presume this would be psychologically bad. You don't prevent them from being with their families and being exposed to their own children and childhood diseases. Would you care to elaborate on that point one at a time?
Well, that's true. We have looked very carefully, Red, at what is an adequate preventive medicine program pre-flight. And, of course, if you were going to do the ultimate, the thing you would do is you would take the crewman and you would literally totally isolate them, just like we do for a quarantine in the post-flight period on the lunar missions. You'd isolate them from everyone except people who had to be with them full-time to provide food and this sort of thing. Now, that's impractical for us to do and launch the mission with the kind of training that we do and the necessity that there is for certain tests and the crew to participate in some of these activities.
It's inhuman, certainly.
Yes, and certainly, and in addition to that, you know, it has certain psychological implications which are of import. Now, it's not an impossibility. I mean, if we felt that the risk was great enough, you certainly could do that. We have decided that the best we can do to be effective is to limit severely the contacts that they have. And this ought to be limited to the people that it's necessary for them to be with from a training point of view, people in the trainers. And we even have a preventive medicine program where we keep very close tab on illnesses in the families of those individuals. And we give them a great deal of instruction. They're told very carefully about reporting any illnesses in their family and anything they've been exposed to, and we do that on a daily basis.
For that reason, Mrs. Lovell had reported to you this case of red measles with her young son,
that's
Jeffrey.
That's correct. Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've also revealed to us that you have an elaborate laboratory for biomedical analysis and that you keep a library of blood samples from the astronauts.
That's correct. And one of the very interesting things, I think, that has some real import to medicine here on the ground is a capability we have to follow very carefully and in detail a group of normal young men, some of them not so young anymore. Now, this is a new approach to medicine, and some of the things we're dealing in here involve trying to predict whether someone is going to become ill from information available to us from the laboratory and from clinical examination. Now, every physician would like to be able to do this, and some of the clues that we can obtain to predicting disease are going to be very valuable to us here on the ground. We've seen some changes, for instance, in the blood smears of individuals looking at particular types of blood cells and things, which give us indication of the possible development of viral disease. Now, these are extremely important when you're faced with a situation that you're going to have a launch within a given time period here, and you absolutely have to decide, are you willing to send that individual or not? We're faced with a very difficult decision point, and you have to say yes or no, and you can't say, well, maybe. It's got to be yes or no. And the physician on the ground many times can find himself in that kind of a situation for particular people. Like you can theorize, for instance, a key actress in a play, for instance, and you could get faced, a physician could get faced with that sort of a situation on the ground.
With no replacement for the actor.
And no replacement. You know, now, it's not, admittedly, it's not as perhaps of the same import as the kind of thing that we're faced with here, but
where
there
where
are
life
situations.
Is in the balance,
right,
yeah.
Where we're faced with really life in the balance, and we have to decide accordingly. So this capability to look at these people in some detail and to have normals for them. One of the very interesting things was in talking to the experts around the country and the world in this process that they were totally amazed that we even knew what the immune status of our crewmen was, because that's a tool that normally is not available to the physician, in that when he sees you, you usually come to him because you are ill, and he sees you. And if he tries to make a diagnosis at that time, then the issue is clouded, because should he determine an immunity level many times at that time, he's going to be in a situation where he doesn't know whether it's this disease or whether you've had it sometime in the past.
But you have the advantage of physiological records dating back into the past on each man who's going to fly.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. It's a very important tool for us to have this particular bank of data, and secondly, to know for a given individual what is normal for him. For instance, in a white blood cell count, a white blood cell count can go up to 10,000, any level within there, and be normal. And any doctor, if you saw a given blood count, it could be 9,800, And you'd say, well, that's within the normal limits. It's at the upper limits of normal, but it's within the normal limits, so you might not be concerned about it. You might be terribly concerned about an 8,000 white count if you knew that you normally ran a 4,000 white count, though, and it's still well within the range of normal. And this is the kind of information we have available to us. And prior to the Apollo 9 flight, for instance, we had the only finding that I had at that time, some 3 days before launch, it was actually at the five-day exam before launch, but that night when we got the laboratory data, it turned out that our clinical examination was perfectly normal, everything was fine, and the only abnormal lab data at all was that there was, in Jim McDivitt, we had... astronaut Jim McDivitt.
This is on Apollo 9.
On Apollo 9, right. That there was a blood count with him that was 8,000. Now, that's certainly within the normal limits. However, Jim McDivitt runs a 4,000 white blood cell count, and this was a double his count.
Okay, hold on a minute. Hello. This is VOA Studio. Hey. Yeah, Maggie, this is Rhett. Let me stop the tape recorder. We were going at it. Wait a minute, let me stop it. That's Maggie. Hello. It's easy for me to get you started and go for hours, so I'm actually cutting you off a little bit to focus. To keep it tight, a little tighter. I'm sorry if it's really
long.
All right.
Well, we are indeed fortunate then to have available a very excellent laboratory capability, a very good bank of data, which we have computerized so that we can even call it up by computer methods and get a printout of all of the past data and all the past medical exams and everything on an individual crewman.
I might have known it. You've computerized the health of the astronauts. It was bound to come.
Almost, yeah, not quite.
Do you think we're going to do that with the general public someday?
Yes, I certainly hope so. There are some tremendous things we can do to give the doctor time to spend with the patient, because if we can ease his capability to look at just things that are normal, if we can let him spend his time looking at the things that are abnormal and talking to the patient and explaining to the patient what the situation is, I think we can get a lot of the humanness back in medicine by using a machine to do it. And that sounds contradictory, but I think that's the only way we're ever going to really do that.
This is too good to pass by without pointing out, then. This in one day will be one of the spinoffs of... the space program, is that you are the first to go this far in analysis of human physiology, I believe.
Yes, I think it is. I think it's one of the more important types of things that we will have come out of the space program and to medicine here on the ground. It's going to give us some diagnostic capability, and it will actually mechanize in many ways some of the activities that take time for the physician to do. We can even do some of this with history taking. You'll never be able to take a totally adequate history this way, but you certainly will be able to pull out a lot of the points that the physician should spend time on.
And it's the funding of the space program, then, that has allowed this progress in medicine to be made. I wonder if it would have been made in the general society, say through the Health Education Welfare Department, if you hadn't already had this focus of aerospace medicine in the space program. This is a question I'm sure that we could only hypothesize about.
Right. I doubt it personally, Rhett, because, and not just because I'm associated with the space program, but
you're a doctor.
I doubt it because that type of activity is something that comes very difficult to medicine, I think. And as a matter of fact, this isn't accepted well by all of the medical profession yet, that is a way that you want to go. I think there are a lot of people who tend to fear computers, as a matter of fact, within the medical profession, because they feel that they don't understand exactly what they will do. They sort of have a fear of being taken over by the computer. That'll never happen, actually, because you have to program that computer, and it can become a tool for you, and it'll only do for you what you want it to do for you. And it can, instead of ruining the doctor-patient relationship, which a lot of people feel that it's going to put a machine between the doctor and his patient, it should do just the reverse. It should utilize that machine to do some of the mundane things and allow the doctor then to talk to his patient, which he gets precious little time to do now.
I think the best argument against the machine taking over really is the third thing that impressed me about your handling of the situation on Apollo 13, and that was the human aspect. I believe astronaut Ken Mattingly said that, "I know that if I had been a black box, a bunch of instruments, you would have replaced me quite a few days ago without thinking about it."
That's exactly right. Ken did say this, and he was aware of the care that was going into this decision, agonizing, you could say, that was going into the decision and the recommendation. Now, obviously, if you had a part that was strictly mechanical and you doubted its capability or thought that there was a 1 in 4 chance only of it performing adequately, you would certainly change that part out prior to flight. And Ken expressed this very well. Now, when it's a human being, it's a much harder to do because human beings have emotions. They can be hurt. They are very important. They're one of the most important parts of this whole system, this whole manned spacecraft system that we have. And you certainly give great pause and consideration to that. I think this was amply shown again on this mission when we got into trouble in flight. Because here again, I think it was demonstrated our extreme concern for man and his capability and the fact that he had to use a lot of ingenuity, as did the people on the ground, in trying to solve these problems which faced the crew as a result of this accident in flight.
If that had been an unmanned craft, just a box of scientific instruments, I presume it wouldn't have been brought back to Earth. It wouldn't have gotten back to Earth.
No, it would not. It certainly would not. And here we had a capability to have a crew react and then to get the support they needed from the rest of the team. And we certainly did a lot of agonized calculations on the ground, and we were worried particularly, of course, about having enough in the way of oxygen supplies. We were worried about the water availability, and the two things that I guess gave me most pause for concern in those last few days were the water availability, because we did want to keep the fluid intake up, and the other problem that we faced was the CO2.
Carbon dioxide removal.
And we had calculated that we did not have enough left in the way of canisters if they all went just their normal usage rates. And we had to figure a way to utilize some of these canisters out of the command module, although they would not fit into the system within the lunar module. And so there was a device developed that whereby we could do that. We tried it in the lab, made sure that it would work and that we could bring the level down, the carbon dioxide level down. We also went on one of the canisters. We doubled our allowable level from medically, and I elected from some studies we'd done in the laboratory to go to 15 millimeters instead of the 7.6 that we normally cut off the use of a canister at.
You mean in use of the removal canister, you approved a higher cleansing level or a longer use of the canister?
Longer use to build up. We built up more carbon dioxide level in the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And we let the level in the cabin get up to a point where it was 14.6. Well, it was actually, we let it go to 15 instead of the 7.6 we normally do.
These figures are somewhat ambiguous to me. They don't mean anything.
Right. We doubled the allowable level of carbon dioxide that we would allow the men to breathe.
Because you had found in other studies it would be okay.
Right. In our laboratory studies, we had calculated that we wouldn't want to do this routinely, but in this situation we felt that it was something we could do without impairing their performance, and we did, and it worked very well. And as a matter of fact, we doubled the lifetime of that cartridge by doing that, as it turned out.
Mm-hmm.
We got twice the lifetime of that cartridge.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Berry, then you were leaning heavily on the progress of aerospace medicine going right back to your days in the Air Force and many of these early studies which began just with high-altitude airplane flight, didn't you?
Yes, there's been a tremendous advance in aerospace medicine over these very few years. In the 10 years that we've really had men flying in the space environment, which is certainly a much more demanding environment than the aircraft environment has been for us, because of the situation in which we find ourselves unable to correct something because of distance involved, as was evidenced on this mission, where we were forced for the best safety reasons to go on around the moon, even though we had this particular incident. It happened at one of the worst times, and you can imagine if you had a real serious medical emergency at that time, here you're committing yourself to another 3.5 days of flight. Now that's a far cry from the sort of thing where you're just an aircraft flight and can come down, or you end up, even in our orbital experience, where
Earth
we could
orbit.
Come down in Earth orbit, you could come down within a very short period of time. You're talking about one rev or two revs at the most, say
just
an hour
one,
and a half
two,
or three hours.
Yeah.
That you're talking about getting down. So it is a much more demanding situation, and we have learned a great deal from our experience with aviation medicine, and certainly the types of consumables that you have to supply haven't changed very much. Man still needs oxygen, and he still needs food, and he still needs to get rid of carbon dioxide, still needs fluid intake, and he needs ways to eliminate both liquid and solid body waste. And all of these factors have to be considered any time that you're trying to develop one of the spacecraft systems. And we rely heavily upon some of our experience with the same kinds of training devices that have been utilized to support high-altitude aircraft flight, the altitude chamber, the centrifuge, the sled that going clear back to the STAP days where we're getting impacts, and all of these same types of tools certainly are
determining
great value
what sort of stress that the human body can take.
Yes, we have, and many times we have to look specifically at some thing that we get some particular problem that relates to a specific system. As an example, we're looking at the shuttle now, and one of the things that we're going to
space shuttle
at the space shuttle, right? It'll be a sort of an airplane-like spacecraft, if you will, that can land on land.
Can fly back.
It could fly back from going to a space station. Now, looking at some of the landing profiles that are planned for this, we feel that it's going to be necessary for us to run some particular studies to determine what the effect on the body is going to be of some of these accelerative loads here, of trying to you'll get some increased G loads that will be the same type of G that you get when you do a pull out or a loop, where you're actually getting the old blackout kind of G, or eyeballs down, footward G, where you're mm-hmm. going to pool blood in the lower part of the body. Now, certainly we're going to have to look at this very carefully because here you have a situation where a man is going to have been weightless for a long period of time, and then you're going to subject him to that kind of a G level. We have no basis for giving a firm answer to that right now from the literature, anything that you can look at in the large amount of literature that's been amassed on acceleration.
Well, let me ask you two quick questions. What have you learned about adapting man to weightlessness? And what have you learned about adapting him to breathe low-pressure, pure oxygen?
Well, in weightlessness, we've learned a great deal. We have better than some 5,000, we have almost 5,800 hours, as a matter of fact, man-hours of exposure to weightlessness. And what we would like to do, of course, is to be assured that the things we are seeing here are adaptive changes, where man is learning to live in this weightless environment. We have seen changes that have involved the heart and blood vessels, the capability to move fluids about in the body, fluid balance. We have seen changes in the calcium level in the bones. We have seen some changes in exercise capacity that involve obviously the musculoskeletal system, the muscles, and the capability to get an adequate amount of oxygen sent to these various muscles. Now, all of these changes are short-lived when we see them post-flight. The changes stay there for about 50 hours post-flight, never any longer than that so far.
The body bounces right back.
Huh? Yes, it comes back within about a 50-hour period. Now, all of these changes, I feel, are occurring over some time course in flight, and what they're showing is that the body is in a less demanding environment when it's weightless, in that you don't have, for instance, the column of blood doesn't weigh anything, and therefore the heart doesn't have to work as hard, and the reflexes don't have to function to help you return blood from the lower portion of the body. As a result, you get some shifts in fluid volume. The blood volume in the upper part of the body increases, and then you get a series of reflexes that act to cause certain hormones to be secreted and tell you to get rid of some fluid, so you tend to diurese. You put out more fluid from the body, and then you have to... This is a protective mechanism, in a way, to get the body back to a new set point, a new level that is demanded of this particular environment. Now, I don't think these things are bad while you're in that environment. Then when you get back, and the same thing with the calcium, it's the same sort of thing. You require less because of less stress on the bone in that particular environment. Now, you come back to a 1G environment, and all these demands of the 1G environment are more. And so you have to take some time to readjust now or readapt back to your normal 1G environment. So I think we are seeing evidence of the body adapting and then readapting. It adapts to 0G and then it readapts to a 1G environment here on Earth. And these are very interesting changes to us. And, of course, the key question is, how long can you go without getting into difficulty when you come back to the 1G environment? In short, do you continue to go downhill all the time in this zero-G environment with prolonged time, or does it plateau and you never get any worse than, say, you were at 14 days?
Well, you need to have longer flights, really, to determine, though.
That's right, and we need longer flights, and we have a 28-day and a 56-day flight planned in an orbital workshop, and we plan to do that in 1972, and that should give us some very key information in this area.
How about a quick word on the pure oxygen, low pressure environment?
Well, now, we have used a 5 psi, roughly a third of an atmosphere pressure with 100% oxygen in all of our spacecraft to date. We launch the Apollo system with some nitrogen in it and then bleed it off and usually end up. We launch it with 60% oxygen, 40% nitrogen, and end up with about 98% oxygen over the entire duration of the flight. Now, our experience with that has been very interesting because we did see where we had strictly the pure oxygen, we did see loss of red blood cells. In short, you would, with exposures of 4, 8, and 14 days of pure oxygen, we at the 8 and 14 day level, we saw losses of red blood cell mass that reached the 20% level. In short, you lost 20% or a fifth of the red cell mass. Now, we had been unable to determine exactly the cause of that. We thought the atmosphere was involved, but we couldn't ferret out some of the other factors. So what we did is decide that we would check it in Apollo with this 60% oxygen, 40% nitrogen, and some little bit of nitrogen always left. We found out that nitrogen will protect against this red cell mass loss. If you have just a little bit of nitrogen in the environment, it will prevent this from happening. And it's raised a whole new series of questions now about whether nitrogen is really inert in the human body or whether it has some activity.
Some catalytic function?
Yes, some function that allows it. It certainly reacts in some way with the red blood cell to be protective to it. And so it probably doesn't just go in and out of the body without any sort of activity at all.
Well, Dr. Berry, we've focused our conversation with you primarily on the trying events of Apollo 13 with astronauts Lovell, Swigert, Hayes, and, of course, Ken Mattingly, very much a part of it from your viewpoint as medical director. And thank you for addressing this conversation particularly for addressing this conversation to our listeners on All India Radio.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it, Rent.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berry, for this conversation for our listeners around the world. Say it again.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you as a group. We always enjoy being able to share medical knowledge with people around the world.
This is Rhett Turner, Voice of America, at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas.
I was trying to wind it or get it. I'm sorry. I didn't mean
we can't.